those and whose people our media continue to dehumanize? Who are we to constrict the movement of our fellow human beings? Who are we to judge how people choose to live? ICE is not welcome here, just like the U.S. is not welcome in other countries. And you, our elected officials, should swear them off, if not in policy, then in spirit, to at the very least pay back your undocumented community members for picking your strawberries. No one is illegal. Power to the people.
So that is John Caravello, who is a faculty member at California State University, Channel Islands, where Angel Marie Taylor, you teach. He was arrested the next day. Can we just have 30 seconds? He hasn't been released yet?
No, Professor Caravello hasn't been released. And as you've heard in that public comment, he has always used his voice to speak up for those around him. Myself as a student coming from an immigrant background, like most other students here in CUC Channel Islands, Professor Caravello has been continuously targeted because of his outspoken views to defend his community. And he was one of the protesters on the ground who was helping other protesters amidst the violence.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to cover this. As the judge in Los Angeles ruled that migrants can no longer be rounded up in Los Angeles without cause, Angel Marie Taylor, student and volunteer with 805 Immigrant Coalition, thank you for being with us. And Luis MacArthur, mayor of Oxnard, 10 miles from Camarillo, previously the police commander of Oxnard. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Portland.
Tune in every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for variations on the theme of folk music during KBOO's Folk Strip. Each morning brings you a different DJ and a wonderful variety of acoustic and roots music, both traditional and contemporary. You'll hear the latest from singer-songwriters, happy jigs and reels, bluesy folk, a sea shanty or two, some old favorites, local artists and artists from around the world, a touch of Cajun, a dose of indie, and a smidge of jug band. It's probably the best way on earth to wake up. So let us start your day with a smile. Again, that's every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for KBOO's folk music programs.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, we'll feature a rebroadcast of our extended interview with United Farm Worker President Teresa Romero. She's speaking out against the Trump crackdown on farm workers. And we also rebroadcast the Electronic Intifada with Nora Barros Friedman. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and now we present to you our interview with the president of the United Farm Workers, Teresa Romero, speaking out against the Trump crackdown on farm workers. You may have heard that, among other things, immigration enforcement operations on farms have left crops rotting, farm operations disrupted in major agricultural states, including California, Texas, and Pennsylvania. Farm owners and industry representatives report that up to 70% of workers stopped reporting to work following immigration and customs enforcement actions, and they have been widespread. We're going going to be talking about this and a number of other related issues with Teresa Romero. We are honored to have her back here on Flashpoints. Ms. Romero, it is good to have you with us. You are the president of the United Farm Workers. They certainly have been spotlighted by the Trump folks and his vision of deporting anybody essentially who isn't white. Things are not looking good. Thanks for joining us. Could you just remind people a little bit about the United Farm Workers, who you represent, and something about the history of the union? Then I really want to get into what's been going on.
Yes, thank you for having me. A pleasure to be with you again. This is a very important issue. The UFW is in existence for over six decades, and our primary focus has been organizing and protecting farm workers. We know that farm workers do not have rights to organize. In 48 of the states in the country, if they only have these rights in California and in New York. So everything that we are able to gain for farm workers, any protection that we are able to attain in any legislation that we're able to pass, it doesn't only benefit the workers that we represent, it helps every single farm worker in this country, and that's exactly what we want to continue doing. When things are so difficult, they need to know that the UFW is here to continue working for them to make sure that they're protected.
And could you talk a little bit about the multiple struggles that have come up, essentially really spread out since Trump took office? Please take a minute or two to give us a sense, because I don't think people understand what it looks like on the ground for brown workers under Trump.
You're absolutely right, Dennis. He has created chaos in the agriculture industry and agriculture areas in this country. A lot of people say farm workers are being detained and arrested. And what I say is farm workers are being kidnapped by people who are wearing a mask, who are not wearing a specific uniform, who are driving vehicles that are unmarked, and they don't have a court order. They don't have a name of a person they're looking for. They don't have any documents signed by the judge saying that they can go in the field, which is private property. And this is something that it should never happen. When we try to find out where the workers are, it's very difficult because we don't have their names. We don't know where they took them. We don't know what agency took them. And it is creating, affecting obviously immediately the lives of the men and women that work in the fields. But it's affecting their families. It's affecting their communities. Farm workers right now go to work and come back. They don't go out into the park with the kids. They don't go out at school functions with the kids. They don't go and have pizza with the kids. So it is affecting their communities. And sooner or later, it's going to affect all of us.
Yes, it is. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are honored to have the president of the United Farm Workers, President Teresa Romero. We're talking about the multiple struggles that are facing farm workers and their families. I went to the UFW website and I saw this absolutely heart-wrenching sound of this man who was beside himself. His wife and young baby had essentially disappeared, been kidnapped. He didn't know where they were. He didn't even know where to start to get help.
Exactly. And that's what we're facing more and more. And that's what I was saying. I have talked to people, to families of those who have been detained or deported. I've talked to children, and we need to remember these children are U.S. citizens, and they are terrified that their parents might be taken. They don't want to go to school because they're afraid that when they come home, mom and dad are not going to be there. And the cruelty that we are seeing in agriculture areas, and like you said earlier, brown people. They are targeting brown people because, they, like I said, they don't even have a name or an arrest warrant. It is just taking any brown person that they find, and some of them at either legal residents or could be citizens. But it is the cruelty, and I just want to believe this is not the country we are. We're much better than that.
Yes, I would hope so. Dennis Bernstein here, also joining our conversation with UFW President Teresa Romero is our senior producer, Miguel Gavilan Molina. Welcome in, Miguel.
Thank you, Dennis, and thank you, President Romero, for joining us. It's a massive concern, and I think one of the most important things, and the farm workers have always been able to do that, is reach out beyond the fields, reach out into cities, into other areas. Because one thing that's really important, I think, in particularly here in the state, is that people need to make the connection with their food and where it comes from. From toiling in the soil to planting, cultivating, growing, harvesting, picking and packing and canning, loading, the food on the trains, on the trucks and so forth, transferring, delivering, the whole preparation of food and serving even comes to the table. At every level of food production and food serving, there are brown hands involved. And most of us that are, from the area, that are Latino, Chicano, Indigena, we all eventually came from the fields. With that said, the most vulnerable workers, because out in the fields, out in the rural areas, President Romero, there's not, a bunch of people, across the street or hanging out in the sidewalks in areas where they can pull out a camera and take pictures of the abuses that happen. Out in the rural areas, there isn't that. So my concern is, Or, for instance, churches stepping up, or community social justice groups stepping up and helping the United Farm Workers. Because, people staying home and not going to work, that means money. That means food. Are people getting food? Are people being helped with food? If people aren't going to work, how are they surviving? Those are big concerns that I have.
Absolutely, and we do have different areas at food drives, but let me tell you something, that misconception is that farm workers are not going to work. Farm workers may not go one or two days when they see a big presence of these vehicles and these people that are detaining immigrants. But we need to remember that they have a family to support. They have a rent to pay. They have utilities. Yes. They have to buy food for their kids.
Yes.
So after a couple of days, they go back to work. And the irony of this is that if you think about it, during the pandemic, Trump said the farm workers were essential. And he said it because he wanted them to keep working. And some of them lost their lives. But they are essential. And they were undocumented, or the majority of them were undocumented in the previous administration. So right now that he surrounded himself with people that are very anti-immigrant and racist, they are now, that all of a sudden, they're not essential anymore. And we're going to find out the hard way. For those who are not, like you just said, you are come and understand agriculture and the hard work that they do every day. But there's a lot of people who don't. And if consumers don't step up and demand that these workers are respected, are giving a path to legalization, they are going to pay the price. Because at one point, we're going to go to the market and we're not going to find everything we want, and whatever we find is going to be very expensive. So we have introduced, and you know that because we talked about it before, once again, the Farm Workforce Modernization Act that will give farm workers a path to legalization. Trump has said in social media and news that he is going to stop the raids, but it's just rhetoric. If he's serious about it, There is a bill that would solve the problem for agriculture, for the that would benefit the workers and ensure that the employers have the workforce, experienced and professional workforce they need. So let's not reinvent the wheel. That's a bill that has support from Republicans. Let's move in. Let's get it to his desk, and he can sign it. These problems will be solved.
I think you're correct, President Romero. You know, and one thing that you pointed out, and it's so true, and that's that farm workers are essential in the food chain. Their brown hands hold the chains of the industrial agricultural empire of California that has made this state the fourth economic power on earth. You know, some of the biggest donors for the Republican, the MAGAs, come out of the San Joaquin and Central Valley. Are some of those agricultural companies, owners, CEOs, are they showing any kind of, you know, voicing their concern, you know, protesting against the administration's, you know, current policies, or are they just holding their breath? One of the things that I've heard, and it kind of made me a little nervous, is that some of these agricultural conglomerates, massive corporations in the valleys, are beginning to hire foreign workers. In other words, not from the Americas, but from other parts of the world. Have you heard anything like that? Are foreign workers being hired to replace farm workers?
That is the problem. There is the guest worker program that workers come here with a visa that is called H-2A. But what the employers want to do is get rid of all the protections, get rid of the wages that they're supposed to be paying. They want to... I don't understand how they want to bring other workers to replace the workers that they already have here that have been working in their farms for years and sometimes decades. It just doesn't make sense. What they want to be able to do is control, have more control of the workers, pay them less, have the ability to say, if a worker said, you did not pay me for my entire week, the first thing that many employers say, is okay, you're going to go back and I'm not going to bring you next year. So that what that does is make it easy for farm workers to be even more abused than what they are right now. And that's one of the things that we don't want. We don't want, you know, just the idea of employers getting to decide which of their workers gets to stay is just wrong. And again, it is the H-2A program in the USW, we call it hardness to abuse, because that is exactly what happens. Farm workers, as it is, they're abused, but this program makes it even easier to abuse the workers.
Listening to Flashpoints.
The other question I have, President Romero, is that, you know, California is a magnet for tourism. You know, the hospitality industry is, you know, major in the state. Well, they depend on food. You know, Cali cuisine, you know, the whole foodie movement is all based around California and its agriculture. Has those industries shown any concern? Have they shown any kind of support for workers, you know, particularly agricultural workers, or is there any discussions between those industries? Because it's going to impact them, you know, when they can't serve up their, you know, world-class, you know, chef's cuisines because they're lacking the ingredients, you know, the vegetables and fruits, and even agricultural includes, you know, the beef industry, that whole, you know, food
dairy,
industry.
Eggs,
have they shown any concern?
We have talked, We have spoken with other unions, especially in the hotel industry, because you're right. We have businesses, we have restaurants who depend on this workforce to make sure that they have what they need to prepare their foods and serve it to their customers and continue their business. That's what I'm saying. If it is going to get to the point where it's going to affect all of us, other unions, we're working with other unions. Unfortunately, this administration wants to govern by tweets or comments in a news channel. And that's not how we, you know, I like to say show, don't tell. You really want to do something, you really want to solve this problem with the need of experienced workers in the agricultural industry, that's the bill that you need to sign. But yes, it is going to affect every single one of us, and that we're going to depend on food that it is imported from other countries. And none of us want that.
This is Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavilán Molina. We are speaking with the president of the United Farm Workers Union, Teresa Romero. We're talking about, we're talking about everything to do with what's happening in the fields, the attacks coming from the federal government. I have to ask you, really at the core of a lot of this struggle is citizenship and the right for the people who do the hardest work in this country to be able to live here in peace and not feel like they are criminals. So this is the battle. On the other side of that, we do see this president, this extreme right-wing president, moving very quickly in the direction of control and deportation. What is your impression? How is the UFW taking, if you will, precautions dealing with the idea of that they're considering a national registry, 25 million naturalized citizens in more jeopardy? How do you think about in terms of your role?
You know, it is not about what he wants to do. Is he's going to be able to say, you know, we are deporting these many thousand, and he's using the word criminals. Farm workers are not criminals. And having a registry, you know, we cannot advise legally the workers, but we inform them what the registry is and what information, personal information they need to provide. And they're the ones that need to make the decision. But the fact that he is referring to brown people as criminals, he ran saying that he was going to deport criminals. And let me tell you something. I can tell him exactly what he needs to, where he can find the criminals in prisons. Those people were afforded already the right to be charged, to be tried, to be found guilty by a jury and sentenced by a judge. That is the process that we have in this country. Farm workers are not criminals, are being kidnapped, and they're disappearing. I don't know where they're sending him. So those things that he says about a registry, those things that he says he's going to stop the raid, those things that he says that he's going to figure out something for the farmers to have their workforce, I can't, you know, again, show, don't tell. I cannot believe anything he says when, like, once again, we have a bill that would solve the problem. And that's exactly what we need to do, and everybody would benefit. We need to remember this bill was negotiated by Republicans, by Democrats, by growers associations, and the UFW. And we all compromised to ensure that the workforce, that the experienced workforce that has been here, would continue to work in agriculture, but at the same time would get the benefit of a path to citizenship. And that's what we need to do. That's how we need to treat this workforce that puts food on our table every single day.
And to be clear, when you say kidnapped, disappearing, this is not hyperbole. This is what's happening on the ground, isn't it? This is
correct.
Part of this
correct.
Terrifying policy.
Exactly, because again, when when you're walking on the street and a masked man comes to you and forces you into a vehicle, what you're going to do is going to fight because you don't know what's happening. And that's what the workers are facing right now. And all because we want to make sure that people see on the news that this administration is deporting criminals. Again, these people are not criminals. These people are doing the work that none of us would be able to do. We need to remember that how physical it is. Here in California, they work in areas where the temperature can get up to 115, 120 degrees. They're bending over, they're on their knees, and people who say they're taking our job, I invite them to apply for a job here to see how long they would last in agriculture.
Yeah. Dennis Bernstein here again with Miguel Gavilán Molina. Gavilán?
Well, it's a big concern. But my question, President Romero, is, you know, we know the situation. Basically, there is a domestic war against the brown masses in this country. And here in California, whether you're a farm worker, domestic worker, day laborer, construction worker, you could, you know, janitor, you can even be what we call a paleta man, you know, selling ice cream and popsicles, you know, out of a little cart, and be susceptible, you know, to be kidnapped. Is the, and again, I look back in the rural areas. I came from a rural town in Sonoma County, Hillsborough, California. And when you're from a little rural town, there's not much, you know, that's going to be there to help you. In those areas, particularly around the valley, you know, where you have little townships, are people there organized? Are they organizing? Is anybody doing, like, community workshops on what to do if the if ICE arrives? And what to do, for instance, if they see unmarked vehicles, you know, people in masks, you don't know who they are. Are people reacting by videotaping them, taking pictures? Are people calling police stations and going, hey, there's some unidentified people here in masks and they have guns? I mean, are you hearing any of that? Or are there workshops helping, you know, to be like quick response to, you know, what I'm calling an invasion of body snatchers? Which are these, you know, who are these people? Mercenaries, bounty hunters, you know, they have a contract with ICE. I mean, I'm concerned about that. Is there a response that the union is taking?
We have been informing workers of their rights. We have been communicating with them since Trump won the election, because we knew that the risk that they were going to face under this administration. We have people sending us videos of how they're chasing workers in the field.
Yes.
And again, they're entering private property. We have been talking to employers and telling them, you don't have to let them in unless they have a court order. Unfortunately, in agriculture, the fields are extensive, and it is very difficult to control, and they know that. But we have been doing this for months. The problem is, like I said, they're not following the Constitution. They're not respecting their rights. They're saying that they want to talk to an attorney, and attorneys go to the detention centers, and they don't let them talk to them. So it is right now the racism that exists, but it is exacerbated by the fact that they are trampling on the Constitution and doing exactly what they want to do. And I don't want to get political here, but the only way that we're going to be able to control this is if we get Congress back to where we can have some level of control and create laws that would stop this from happening. This administration has no control, are doing exactly whatever they want.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, ICE has become, you know, ICE, inhumane cruelty enforcement by the government. It's just out of control and lawless. That said, you know, and I see the process, you know, case after case after case goes to the courts. But in this instance, again, my concern is the safety of the workers and their familias, their families. And again, something interesting has happened. A lot of farm workers, a lot of Spanish-speaking communities are Catholics. And, you know, a Catholic Pope was just elected, you know, that is from the United States. You know, an idea, somebody said, hey, maybe the farm workers, because they always carry the Virgin of Guadalupe, La Tonantzin, in their walks, in their marches, in their activities. Have you attempted to reach out to the Pope? Because he is from the country. He has taken a stance against the abuse of, you know, immigrants in this country. Is that something that, you know, you might consider?
You know, we have reached out to a couple of bishops, the Archbishop of Los Angeles, and asked for help. The bishop from Brennan from Fresno is going to officiate mass to make sure that farm workers understand that, and not only farm workers, all immigrants understand that the church is with them. I had not thought about reaching to the Pope, but I think that's something that we will definitely consider, because yes, he is a person president, from what he has said, that supports immigrants, supports human beings, supports not separating parents from their children, their parents, their spouses. That is what we need to stop. And I will do what I can to reach out to him.
Can I, before we let you go, I'm sorry, Gavilan, we're running out of time, but before I let you go, President Romero, I want to bring it back to the children. And I've been hearing some interesting things, the new generation sort of standing up, those who have citizenship standing for their parents and the elders. There's been a real resistance within the farm worker community. There's been organizing, but it's also been a situation of terror for many young people who stopped going to school. Is that your understanding, that people are now afraid to go to school, to use the various centers? Is there a special caution being taken now?
You know, both the parents and the children are afraid to go to school. What we are focusing with the parents is, you know, making sure that especially the children have to try to continue as a life that is as normal as possible under the circumstances. So what we're working with communities is figuring out who can take the children to school. You know, a neighbor that is a citizen. The child care that takes care of the kids, you know, picking them up, taking them to school, and then from school picking them up and taking them to child care. We're trying to figure out how we can do that as much as possible. And we're also trying to let them know to be prepared, unfortunately, for the worst. If this is happening, it happens to one of them, are they prepared? Do the kids know where they need to go? The other spouse that is not working in agriculture, or the stay-at-home parent, do they know where the car, who's the papers for the car, who they pay the rent to, you know, things that unfortunately, I wish we didn't have to go through, but we're doing that, because if they're detained, we want to make it as not easy. And I can't even find the word as less traumatic, in the sense that at least the family knows what they need to do. But it is sad that we have to prepare the families for something like that.
Wow. Well, we, Miguel and I, are grateful that you could take the time out to join us today. It's an honor to be with you and to have you on to share this kind of crucial information. You are the president of the United Farm Workers. That's a very important and unique institution that represents, as I said earlier, the people who do the hardest work in this country, who make our tables beautiful, who make it possible for us to live, are now being brutalized, undermined, mistreated, disparaged, and the situation under Trump is not seem to be getting any better. So we thank you for the information, and we hope that you will stay safe. And Miguel and I would love to talk to you again in the future.
Thank you very much, of course, and I appreciate you bringing attention to this important issue.
Thank you.
listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And as we do every Thursday, we begin the show with the newscast from the Electronic Intifada with Nora Barrows-Friedman.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 636 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has bombarded areas across Gaza this week, killing 630 Palestinians and wounding more than 2,300 between June 25th and July 2nd in airstrikes, tank shellings, and by snipers, in attacks on residential buildings, tent shelters, cafes, and at U.S.-run so-called aid distribution sites. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza said today, Thursday, July 3rd, that 118 Palestinians were killed and 581 injured since Wednesday evening, including 12 people killed and 49 injured at the U.S. and Israeli-backed aid centers, it added. Since late May, when operations at these U.S.-Israeli sites began, 652 starving Palestinians have been killed trying to obtain food aid. 24 people were killed on Wednesday trying to obtain a box of food. We'll have more on the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation in a few minutes. The United Nations Humanitarian Office stated on June 30th that the Israeli military had issued yet another displacement order for people in areas of Jabalia and Gaza City in northern Gaza, affecting at least 150,000 Palestinians, and followed other orders in central Gaza just days before. People are being pushed into overcrowded areas where thousands of others are already staying, the UN adds. These spaces lack shelter, water, and sewage systems, as well as adequate medical facilities. And they are being bombed. On Tuesday, July 1st, at least 17 Palestinians were killed when Israel bombed a building housing forcibly displaced families in the Zeitoun neighborhood of Gaza City. Mahmoud Bassal, the spokesperson for Gaza's civil defense, said that Israeli forces bombed 25 homes in Gaza City on Tuesday alone. Bassal added that the Israeli raids resulted in the deaths of 70 people that day, including 11 people waiting for aid, 12 children and 14 women, in addition to more than 200 wounded, some of whom are in critical condition. Euromed Human Rights Monitor said that 5 people, including 2 children, were killed when Israeli airstrikes attacked the tents of displaced people in Al-Mawasi, west of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, also on Tuesday. Al-Mawasi is where Israel has ordered Palestinians in the north to flee. Journalist Nahed Hajjaj documented the aftermath of Tuesday's attacks from the Al-Ahli Arab Hospital in Gaza City, and spoke to a 10-year-old boy, Zain, who was taking care of his wounded younger siblings. That was a clip by reporter Nahed Hajjaj in Gaza City on Tuesday. On Monday, June 30th, Israel bombed the crowded Baqa Cafe on the seaside in Gaza City, killing more than 30 Palestinians, including children, and those gathering for a child's birthday party. The cafe was a gathering spot for families who sought a moment of rest from the bombings and for journalists who needed internet access and a place to charge their phones. A survivor of the attack, Ali Abu Atayla, who was inside the cafe when it was bombed, told the Associated Press that, quote, without a warning, all of a sudden, a warplane hit the place, shaking it like an earthquake. Ismail Abu Hatab, a photojournalist who worked with various media outlets and who organized photo exhibitions outside Palestine, was killed in the bombing. The Gaza government media office said that Abu Hatab is the 228th reporter and media worker to be killed by Israel since October 2023. Also on June 30th, the Israeli army bombed the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah for the 12th time in 21 months. The government media office said that Israel targeted a tent for displaced persons inside the hospital compound, resulting in injuries and material damage to the medical facility. Al Jazeera's Tarek Abu Azoum reported from the site.
Israeli military has just targeted Al-Aqsa, the courtyard of Al-Aqsa Hospital at the moment. This has been a huge explosion, and there are people inside. The Israeli military till now did not warn this area before it was struck, and the hospital is in a state of emergency. As we can right now see, this is a makeshift tent that was struck, and rescue operations are just trying to take place at the moment by several defense members.
That was Tarek Abu Azoum reporting on June 30th at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in central Gaza. Meanwhile, Israeli and American forces continue to use the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation aid distribution sites as killing fields. Since the private U.S.-led mercenary company began operations just over a month ago, at least 652 Palestinians have been killed, more than 4,500 Palestinians have been injured, and dozens remain missing while trying to obtain meager amounts of food. Euromed Human Rights Monitor stated this week that, quote, through the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, Israel has introduced a new killing mechanism cloaked in a humanitarian facade, further escalating the genocide in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli army's targeting of starving people near distribution centers has become a systematic daily practice, carried out openly before the world, with international silence perpetuating impunity and allowing this dangerous pattern to continue unpunished, the rights group added. This occurs as the international community, states, and institutions remains unable to take serious action to hold Israel accountable for its crimes, compel it to permit independent relief organizations to resume their work in the Gaza Strip, and lead humanitarian efforts that ensure the population's vital needs are met while safeguarding their lives and dignity. Doctors Without Borders said that the U.S.-Israeli scheme, quote, is slaughter masquerading as humanitarian aid and must be immediately dismantled. An emergency coordinator for Doctors Without Borders in Gaza said, quote, the four distribution sites, all located in areas under the full control of Israeli forces after people had been forcibly displaced from there, are the size of football fields surrounded by watch points, mounds of earth, and barbed wire. The fenced entrance gives only one access point in or out. GHF workers drop the pallets and the boxes of food and open the fences, allowing thousands in all at once to fight down to the last grain of rice. If people arrive early and approach the checkpoints, they get shot. If they arrive on time but there is an overflow and they jump over the mounds and the wires, they get shot. If they arrive late or they shouldn't be in there because it's an, quote, evacuated zone, they get shot, the worker added. On July 1st, more than 160 non-governmental organizations operating in Gaza issued an urgent call for immediate action to end the slaughter at the military-controlled food distribution sites. Quote, concentrating more than 2 million people into further confined areas for a chance to feed their families is not a plan to save lives, the joint statement said. These areas have become sites of repeated massacres in blatant disregard for international humanitarian law. Orphan children and caregivers are among the dead, with children harmed in over half of the attacks on civilians at these sites. With Gaza's healthcare system in ruins, many of those shot are left to bleed out alone, beyond the reach of ambulances and denied life-saving medical care. The groups demanded that third-party states not fund these militarized schemes, but instead support the restoration of, quote, a unified UN-led coordination mechanism grounded in international humanitarian law, inclusive of UNRWA, Palestinian civil society, and the wider humanitarian community to meet people's needs. This past week, the U.S. State Department approved $30 million in funding for the shadowy U.S.-based Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, with Reuters reporting that the U.S. could approve the same amount every month for an indefinite period. Sources speaking anonymously to Reuters said that the State Department, quote, exempted the foundation, which has not publicly disclosed its finances, from an audit usually required for groups receiving USAID grants for the first time. The foundation, which is reportedly based in Delaware but has no clear paper trail behind it, attempted to register an affiliate in Geneva, but it came under legal scrutiny by the Swiss government over its failure to fulfill legal requirements to operate in Switzerland, Reuters reported, including having the correct number of board members, a postal address, or a Swiss bank account, none of which were provided. Swiss media reported on Wednesday that the Swiss Federal Supervisory Authority for Foundations ordered the formal dissolution of the Geneva affiliate of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Part of the plan had to go through Switzerland to try to attract funding under the banner of Neutrality and International Geneva, a central hub of international diplomatic missions, reported the Swiss broadcaster RTS earlier this week. According to information from the RTS Investigation Unit, a network of business agents helped find a Swiss representative, in this case, a lawyer with a presence in Geneva. International business partners with whom he regularly dealt convinced him to provide the foundation with an address and a representative in Switzerland as required by law. Journalists approached the Geneva lawyer to respond to information that was beginning to leak from the United States and Israel about the reality of the foundation's plan, which was more military than humanitarian, RTS reported. The lawyer resigned the same day that an article in the Swiss newspaper Le Temps was published. The lawyer said that he resigned after realizing that international business partners had approached him without providing him with full information about the reality of the plan surrounding the foundation. That administrator was never active with the foundation, and no bank account had ever been opened, RTS added. While people are killed every day at these so-called aid sites, and as thousands of tons of food, medicine, fuel, and supplies remain trapped on the other side of Israeli checkpoints just kilometers away, Palestinian children are dying of starvation. The Gaza government media office stated on June 28th that at least 66 children have been killed as a result of malnutrition and Israel's policy of deliberately depriving children of baby formula, nutritional supplements, and food. As the Electronic Intifada's senior editor Maureen Claire Murphy recently reported in her article, No Truce on Horizon as Gaza's Children Starve, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights warned that hundreds of infants and premature babies face life-threatening danger amid a shortage of therapeutic milk. Fortified milk is essential for infants with certain health conditions, but supplies have run out at Gaza's neonatal intensive care units and have all but disappeared in local markets due to Israel's severe restrictions on what enters Gaza's crossings, Murphy wrote. Dr. Jamil Suleiman, the director of Al-Rantisi Hospital in Gaza City, told the Associated Press that fortified formula required for newborns is out of stock and that many mothers, quote, are unable to breastfeed due to severe malnutrition. An American doctor told the French publication Le Monde Diplomatique that in preparation for his recent travel to Gaza on a medical mission, he had packed his suitcases full of basic medical supplies such as gauze, bandages, and sanitary pads, and several cans of baby formula. Once he arrived at the Allenby Bridge crossing, Israeli officers searched his bags and confiscated the baby formula. The coordinator of the medical convoy, Diana Nazal, told Le Monde, quote, the baby formula was confiscated. What other explanation is there if it's not that hunger is being used as a weapon of war in the ongoing genocide in Gaza? The ongoing ban of fuel into Gaza will imminently shut down essential facilities, the UN warned on June 30th. and will impact hospitals, water and sanitation equipment, telecommunications, the movement of cargo from crossings, and the operation of community kitchens. Already, the Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza reported that Al-Shifa Medical Complex has suspended its kidney dialysis services due to fuel shortages, and that intensive care services will be limited to a few hours each day, the UN added. Al Jazeera reporter Hani Mahmoud stated on Tuesday that Al-Shifa Hospital, quote, was once the largest healthcare facility in Gaza, but has slowly turned into a waiting room for death, not just because of the war wounds, but because of a lack of fuel that keeps everything running. This shows that survival in Gaza is not just about escaping the airstrikes, but also about keeping the power on so patients can survive, he said. On January 25th, the World Health Organization said it was able to deliver its first medical shipment into Gaza since March 2nd, a small convoy of 9 trucks carrying essential medical supplies, 2,000 units of blood, and 1,500 units of plasma. The blood and plasma were delivered to Nasser Medical Complex's cold storage facility for onward distribution to hospitals facing critical shortages, amid a growing influx of injuries, many linked to incidents at food distribution sites, said the WHO spokesperson. However, Dr. Izzedine Shahab, a physician and writer in Gaza, announced this week that saline has run out at the Al-Ahli Hospital in Gaza City. He writes, quote, "There is no medicine left here, not for the body, not for the soul. I have long spoken of the disintegration of Gaza's hospitals, how we labor beneath roofs that leak shrapnel, beside beds where children lie half alive. The World Health Organization calls it a collapse. Collapse is too gentle a word. This is annihilation. Today at Ahli Al-Arabi Hospital, we lost the last of our saline. Yes, saline, salt and water, the most elemental tool of medicine. Without it, we cannot hydrate the sick, cleanse a wound, keep a child alive through the night. Without it, our hands are not healing hands. They are hands that bury the living. This morning, a boy was carried in, limp and burning with fever. His father had wrapped his leg in a torn t-shirt soaked with old blood. We had no IV solution, no sterile wash. We used boiled water and a prayer. I looked at the boy's eyes. He did not cry. He had passed beyond crying. In another room, a mother whispered that she feeds her infant boiled lentil water, not out of neglect, out of poverty, out of starvation. Formula now costs more than the monthly aid they no longer receive. She cradled her child with the tender silence of someone who has already rehearsed the funeral. You want numbers? I will not give them. Numbers dehumanize. They make the dead easier to digest. Instead, I give you this: the sound of a child gasping through dust, the look in a nurse's eyes as she realizes she has nothing left to offer, the quiet, unbearable dignity of a people condemned to die tidily, without spectacle. Those are the words of Dr. Izzedine Shahab, writing from Gaza City. One of Gaza's leading doctors was killed along with his family in an Israeli airstrike on their tent shelter in Gaza City on Wednesday. Dr. Marwan Al-Sultan was a cardiologist and the director of the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza, and was the 70th healthcare worker to be killed in the last 50 days, according to Healthcare Workers Watch, speaking to The Guardian. Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmiya, the director of Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City and a longtime colleague of Dr. Sultan, said that, quote, he was a prominent scholar and one of the two remaining cardiologists left in Gaza. Thousands of heart patients will suffer as a result of his killing. His only fault was that he was a doctor. We have no option but to be steadfast, but the sense of loss is devastating. International human rights organizations have renewed their calls to release Dr. Hossam Abu Safiya, the director of Kamal Adwan Hospital, who was abducted by Israeli soldiers at the end of December 2024 and remains in Israeli detention. Dr. John Collar, the co-founder of the Chicago-based medical organization MedGlobal, spoke to NBC News on June 26th and said that he was, quote, very afraid that Abu Safiya won't make it out alive from Israeli jail. Abu Safiya was MedGlobal's lead physician in Gaza. The organization said that five other members of its medical staff are among the approximately 180 civilian health workers from Gaza still held without charge in Israeli prisons. In a new joint statement, 23 civil society organizations, including GLIA, Human Rights Watch, Doctors Without Borders, Physicians for Human Rights, and Médecins du Monde International Network, are calling for the immediate release of the imprisoned health workers. On June 29th, Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya was awarded the 2025 Human Rights Award by the Palestine-based Lawyers for Justice organization, which said, quote, this award aims to shed light on the sacrifices made by human rights defenders, particularly in the face of the ongoing genocide against civilians in Gaza and the suppression of freedoms. It also seeks to highlight the suffering of political prisoners and those who defend dignity under fire and bombardment. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight how a new vocabulary is emerging in the genocide by Yusuf Al-Nono, writing from Gaza. Yusuf talks about many new words, quote, that are making their way into our vocabularies, words that we must now use to match the many unbelievable situations we find ourselves in. We are living in a surreal reality with new Gazawi vocabulary to match, he writes. Gaza was not a quiet place before the war, but people got used to the annoying sounds of al-zanana, or drones. But I don't think we will get used to the sky-splitting roar and high-pitched screeches of the fighter planes that fly overhead. In December 2024, my friend Mahmoud and I were chopping wood for a fire. I had not known Mahmoud for a long time. He was displaced from the nearby Al-Karama area. He was forced to stay at his aunt's house in our neighborhood because his house had been destroyed by an Israeli attack. After a short time, I got to know him a little better and we became friends. Nearby, a group of children were playing as we chopped wood, and then we all heard the abrupt and terrifying shrieking sound of the jet. We covered our heads and got low to the ground, anticipating a missile strike. The children were terrified, and their little bodies shook with fear. They also thought it was a missile coming for us and started screaming. I tried to calm the kids down. I told them it was not a missile, that it was an F-16 that had come very close to the ground in order to confuse people and spread fear. Mahmoud said to the children, "Don't be afraid. The plane shahatat." Before that day, I had only heard the verb shahat in the context of a car screeching to a halt, like when a car travels at a high speed and suddenly slows down. The loud noise that follows, that is from shahat. Now I understand the word in a different way. Every time I hear the sound of a plane ripping across the sky, I say shahatat, shahatat, to calm myself. Those are excerpts from Yusuf Al-Nono's feature, How a New Vocabulary is Emerging in the Genocide, on electronicintifada.net. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine and around the world. Photojournalist Haneen Salem took photos of a group of boys in Gaza. She says, quote, in a courtyard shattered by war and stripped of all signs of life, I found children sweeping the rubble with their tiny hands, trying to bring back a place that was once a playground. They ran barefoot after a faded ball, as if chasing days that haven't arrived yet. I walked closer and asked one of them, "Aren't you scared of the drones?" He looked up, breathless, and said, "When did we ever stop playing?" I smiled, not because the place was safe, but because their souls still believed that playing here in Gaza is the purest form of survival. And that's from the photojournalist Haneen Salem. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
Does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. If you're able, please go to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution in support of the critical work of community radio. Thank you.